Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 70% of us take prescription drugs, and most of those drugs are generics. The global generic drug market is expected to reach $169 billion next year, according to a report from BCC Research. Last month, the Supreme Court came down with two very important rulings that will greatly affect those of you who take generics. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court overturned a lower court ruling that had awarded Karen Bartlett, a New Hampshire woman, $21 million for pain and suffering. After taking a generic version of an anti-inflammatory drug, Celindac, for her shoulder pain, Bartlett suffered the equivalent of third-degree burns over more than half of her body. She was left permanently disfigured, legally blind, and with permanent damage to her lungs and esophagus. According to a New York Times editorial called A Damaging Decision on Generic Drugs, the decision leaves little recourse for those of us who are harmed by generic drugs. And then in another decision, this one was 5-3, the court ruled that profit-sharing deals between brand name and generic drug companies that preserve patents and delay the introduction of cheaper drugs can be challenged as anti-competitive. So what do these rulings mean for those of us who take generic drugs? And what are the economics and politics behind the generic drug industry? 80% of all prescription drugs are generics. Today, we're joined by Dr. Jerry Avorn. He's professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and an internist in the Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's the author of Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. And he joins us from Boston. Hi, Dr. Avorn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you. And we are also joined by Emily Rush, State Director of CalPERG, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest advocacy organization who closely follows these issues. And Emily joins me in studio. Hi, Emily. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So, Dr. Avorn, you wrote a great editorial in the New York Times recently called Healing the Overwhelmed Physician. And you write that it would take dozens of hours each week for a conscientious primary care doctor to read everything he or she needed in order to stay current, a dizzying and impractical prospect. And just as an average person, it would take so much time to keep current on the drug industry, especially those of us who take the drugs. And it's so interesting to think about the fact that generics account for 80% of all prescription drugs. When did this happen?
It's been a trend that's been going on for the last many years. As generics have become more easy to bring to market because of some legislation that happened in the 1980s, we've seen more and more drugs go generic, which is really a very good thing because the original company gets a certain amount of years of patent protection. It can make a lot of money off of the drugs it brings to market. And then that comes to an end, like all good things must do. And when the patent is over, then any company that can make a quality product can make their own version of the drug once it is off patent. And that benefits patients, it benefits payers, it benefits taxpayers who pay for a lot of medical care. And in general, this has been a very good development and has literally saved hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars in healthcare over the last many years.
And can you paint us a picture of what this looks like? I'm trying to picture the generic drug companies on one side of a chart and then the brand name on the other. Are they always separate?
No, they're in fact not. And one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that many of the generic drugs are actually made by subsidiaries of the very big pharmaceutical companies like the Pfizers of the world. And so they account for a lot of so-called generic drugs, but they make them as unbranded generics much more cheaply. But it's the same companies making the same products as they used to. And then there are other companies which are purely generic companies which only make generic drugs. But the FDA holds all generic manufacturers to a very high standard of purity and of potency so that when you get a generic, you can feel comfortable that it has been inspected and manufactured well, is as good as the...
Dr. Avorn, we're having
yes.
some problems with the line. I'm not sure if it's your end, but it's a little choppy. We're going to try to call you right back. That's Dr. Jerry Avorn, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. And Emily, what are your thoughts on just the explosion of generic drugs? Again, 70% of Americans take prescription drugs. 80% of those drugs are generics.
Right. Right. I mean, there's no question the prescription drug industry is saving lives, right? There's lots of medicines that have come onto the marketplace that are allowing people to live longer, live healthier, live without pain. However, we are concerned that too often consumers are spending too much money on prescription drugs. And there's a particular practice that we've focused on that's known in the industry as pay for delay. It's where a name brand company will pay off a competitor to avoid bringing competition to the market.
Okay, can you give us a specific example? Because this was one of the cases the Supreme Court ruled on just recently.
That's right. In fact, it's actually very common that a name brand company will, as the doctor noted, it'll have a patent, often on both its active ingredient as well as on other features of the drug, like whether or not it's in a gel cap form or aspirin form. What will happen is that a generic company will threaten to challenge a patent that seems too weak. Rather than take that to court, the name brand company will just pay off the generic to delay having competition on the market for years. The Federal Trade Commission estimates that consumers spent $3.5 million more on prescription drugs than they should have because of this practice.
And how do they do it exactly?
It's a settlement. I mean, it's a deal where the name brand company wins because they get to keep their monopoly on the market for years longer than they otherwise would have. The generic company gets a monetary settlement for doing nothing and sitting on their hands, but consumers lose out.
How often does this happen?
We have looked at certainly most of the major prescription drug companies do this practice. Pay for delay has postponed at least 142 generics from coming onto the market, according to the Federal Trade Commission. So it's a pretty frequent practice.
And so talk about the 5-3 Supreme Court decision that greatly affects pay for delay.
Sure. Right. So the Supreme Court decided in June that this practice may be anti-competitive and illegal, but they didn't make a definitive ruling. So our advocates, we've gone back to Congress and said, you guys should actually just make a definitive ruling. This is an anti-competitive practice at its core. It's one company paying off another to keep their monopoly. It should be illegal. And there's a bill that's currently pending in the Senate that would do just that.
And Dr. Avorn, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm back. I hope it works better.
Much better. Thank you. So we were just talking, Emily was just talking about pay for delay and the Supreme Court decision. As a doctor, can you just give us your overall thoughts on pay for delay and how this affects citizens who need generic drugs or might only be able to afford generic drugs?
Right. I was surprised that this was allowed to go on as long as it did. I agree with Emily that it was a helpful decision that the court said that if somebody who owns a patent pays a potential competitor to not make that product, that sure looks like some sort of need for an antitrust decision. And we may be moving in that direction, because the concern that a lot of physicians have is that when we prescribe a drug for a patient, we'd like the patient to be able to afford to take it. We have a lot of problems that patients don't take their meds, and often it's because they simply cannot afford the high price tag, and that in turn results in untreated diabetes, untreated blood pressure, and so forth. So it's very good that whenever we can have a decision that enables people to be able to get their medications at an affordable price.
What do you think of the Supreme Court decision, the 5-3 ruling on pay for delay, and how will this change the whole system and how these generic drugs make it to market?
Well, hopefully, as Emily said, this can pave the way for even more legislation that will say that it's not legal to pay a generic manufacturer to stay out of the marketplace, because that's not what was intended originally by the founding fathers when they wrote our patent laws. The idea was that the patents expire, and then any company can make the drug once the original company has made its share of its profits. And I would love to see that continue, mostly because I would like for patients to be able to afford what we prescribe for them.
Two senators want to completely do away with these agreements: Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota and Republican Charles Grassley of Iowa say that they force citizens to pay much higher prices for critical drugs. What are your thoughts about this bill when you think about how much power the pharmaceutical industry has in Washington?
Well, that's a two-part question.
Yes.
What do I think of the bill? I think it's a very good idea to say that, and I would have thought this would already have been in the law, but apparently it isn't, that it's illegal to pay your competitors to stay out of the market. That ought to be the law, and if it isn't, I applaud the senators who've introduced it. But the second part of your question, in light of the pharmaceutical industry's clout in Washington, they have enormous power, and they spend an enormous amount on lobbyists, and our Congress people seem to be very susceptible to that kind of influence, and so it's not clear where that legislation is going to go, but I certainly hope it passes.
And now, when you talk about power in Washington, are you putting the brand name companies and the generics in the same box? I know that some companies do both, but does the generic drug industry have a lot of power in Washington?
It has only a small fraction of what the branded pharmaceutical manufacturers have, just because the number of dollars of profit is so much greater for the big pharmaceutical companies like Merck and Lilly and Glaxo than it is for the generic manufacturers, which are often much smaller. So the degree of clout is considerably different. Although I would be interested in knowing, there may be some generic manufacturers that kind of like the old arrangement perfectly fine, because they actually could make more money by not producing a generic drug if they were paid to not do so by a big drug company. And so they may well have some mixed motivation there in terms of this new legislation.
Well, I mean, obviously the payment depends on the profit. But Emily, is there any sort of approximation? I mean, how much are the drug brand name companies paying off the generics?
I don't know. I can give you I can give you a concrete example.
Please,
that happens. So first I'll highlight a woman named Karen Winkler, who's a wife and mother of three in Michigan. She has multiple sclerosis and suffers from chronic fatigue as a result. She reported that Provigil, which is a name brand drug to treat chronic fatigue, worked wonders for her and really helped her quality of life improve. But it's an expensive brand name drug. And even with insurance, she was still having to pay $500 a month in out-of-pocket costs just to take this drug.
Wow.
So she reports that she was often skipping pills or splitting doses or just going without, frankly, for months when she couldn't afford it. Now that there's a generic on the marketplace, she's only having to spend a $16 copay for a 3-month supply.
$16 for 3 months versus $500 for 1 month.
Exactly. So dramatic decrease in her out-of-pocket costs to be able to access this medicine. We know that the name brand drug company, Cephalon, who makes Provigil, paid a series of settlements amounting to $200 million to avoid having these generics come on the market for 6 years. So she was paying that higher price for 6 years longer than she needed to.
Another example, people with high cholesterol pay as much as $205 for a 30-day supply of Lipitor. The generic version costs $18. While the generic was delayed, Pfizer made $7.4 billion on sales of Lipitor just in the last year. I mean, we're talking like a lot. This is a lot of money we're talking about, Dr. Avorn.
Yes, it is. And the insidious part of that old arrangement was that everybody got rich off of it except for patients and taxpayers, because the brand name companies could continue to charge a huge amount for their drugs as long as they were able to postpone the availability of generics. And a lot of the generic manufacturers were able to say, great, this is free money. We don't need to actually make anything, and they pay us not to make the drug, so it's good for them too. And the only people that get hurt are the patients who have to pay for the drugs, and ultimately the taxpayers, where if a patient is getting a drug from Medicare or Medicaid or even through a private insurer, everybody ends up paying for that increased cost.
So what explains the price discrepancy? A 30-day supply of Lipitor for the brand name is $205. The generic is only $18. I mean, that's a huge... you're saving so much money there. Why? Why is the generic so much cheaper?
Well, it really costs only pennies to make most of the medications that are certainly the small molecules that are in pill form, like the cholesterol drug that you mentioned. Really, if you look at what does it cost to actually make the next million pills, it's a few pennies per pill. But the U.S. is really the only country in the world where what a drug costs is determined solely by whatever the manufacturer chooses to charge for it. And of course, all that price control goes away when there are a dozen generic manufacturers in the field, and then they can compete the way marketplaces are supposed to work. But as long as the drug is still under patent, the company can say, we're going to charge $5 a pill, $12 a pill, whatever they like. And if you don't like the price, then the answer is, well, you're not going to get the pill.
I was wondering when we were putting the show together if there's a generic version of Viagra, because that drug makes so much money. But there's not, right, Dr. Avorn? And why not?
Well, a drug patent exists for as long as the patent allows it to exist, and then it goes generic. But one of the things that we've been looking at in our division here with Dr. Kesselheim in my group, who's a lawyer and an internist, is that companies can sometimes extend the patent life of their drug by patenting the shape, patenting the appearance, patenting the coating of the pill. And there are a number of things that are called evergreening, which is sort of a euphemism for trying to stretch out your patent life longer than it should be, in which companies can go ahead and make their patents last longer than the patent law originally intended.
Right. And that's my understanding. That's often when these pay-for-delay deals are happening. There is technically a patent on the name brand drug, but it's not on the active ingredient. It's on some side form, you know, some smaller version of the change to the drug that they've made.
And Rose, the way this relates to a lot of your listeners is that patients should, for one thing, feel quite comfortable about getting a generic, because, as I said, I don't know if this was the part of my comments where the sound wasn't working, but FDA does require that any generic manufacturer that sells a drug in the U.S. has to show that it is as effective and bioavailable and potent and pure as the original manufacturer's drug is. So one thing that would actually be useful for everyone to understand is that generics are every bit as good as the brand name products. Mm. And there should never be any hesitation if a doctor or a pharmacist says, here's a generic version, it's just like X, then the answer should be, thanks very much, I'm glad to have the extra money in my pocket, as opposed to, you know, I want the brand name product, which is not going to be necessarily any better, but it'll cost a lot more.
That is Dr. Jerry Avorn, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and an internist in the Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's the author of Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Cost of Prescription Drugs. And be sure to check out his recent New York Times op-ed, Healing the Overwhelmed Physician. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. In his piece, he writes about the nation's $325 billion prescription drug market. 70% of us take prescription drugs, and 80% of those drugs are generics. We're also joined by Emily Rush, State Director at CalPERG, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest advocacy organization. And today we are talking about the generic drug market and the latest Supreme Court rulings. What do they mean for those of us who take generics? And what are the politics and the economics behind generic drugs? If you've switched between generics and brand name medications, what's the effect been like? And then also, I'd love to hear stories about the cost savings. I mean, it's incredible when you look at the discrepancy between the brand name and the generics. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you work in the generic industry, we'd love to hear from you. And then we're going to talk about the other very important Supreme Court decision that prohibits people who take generics from suing for defective medicines. Have you ever noticed a side effect? Do you pay close attention to the labels? We'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Dr. Avorn, before we talk about that other important decision, does the decision affecting when the drug comes to market, does that give the generic drug company more power?
Sorry, you mean the decision about pay for delay?
Pay for delay, yes. Thank you.
Well, I think it gives patients more power, and it may be that some generic companies are going to feel that it gives them less power because, as I said, they had some of them that chose to engage in this business of pay for delay had a very cushy arrangement where they would simply threaten the manufacturer of the trade name drug, I'm going to make your product unless you essentially pay me some blackmail not to. And then they were able to have a very easy arrangement of being paid not to make a drug. So some of them are probably going to wish for the old days where they could simply threaten to make a drug and then get millions of dollars to not make it. But I think most of the more down-to-earth, honorable generic manufacturers will probably be okay with this decision.
And then another question on pay to delay and just the differences actually between generics and brand name. Teva Pharmaceuticals manufactures Plan B, which is also called the morning after pill, and it has an arrangement with the FDA that allows the product to be sold to women and girls of all ages, while generic versions of Plan B require the buyer to be 17 years of age. Can you explain this? How did this happen?
I sure can't. It makes no sense at all. I'm not aware of that legal distinction, but if we assume that the generic is exactly the same molecule as the brand name drug, there is no logical reason why that should be there should be any difference. We know that Plan B has really been kind of a poster child for administrative malfeasance in Washington, where it was really subjected to a whole lot of completely unscientific restrictions because of pressure from people who didn't think women should have the right to terminate a pregnancy with a pill. And over the years, the FDA has been in the middle of making some very bad decisions about it. But as far as why the generic versus the trade name should be any different legally, that makes no sense at all.
Do you think it might have something to do with profit?
It's hard. There is such a swirl of economics, but added to that, the political issues around contraception.
Right.
I wouldn't even begin to try to explain how that came to be.
Hmm. Well, it's really interesting, and we'll put some information on our website about that. Let's hear from a few of our callers. Let's go to Drew in San Francisco. Hi, Drew. Welcome to the show.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is because you're referring to the prices of drugs as if they're the real prices for the drugs, but they're the actual subsidized prices subsidized by Medicare, Medicaid, our insurance companies. So drug may be $16 to me, but to the insurance company, it can be $300, $500 for that monthly supply. And if you look at the $500 ProVigil, something I was familiar with, one of your guests talked about, that drug at $500 for the monthly supply to the customer was actually somewhere close to $2,000, perhaps, to the insurance company.
Ah, okay. So, interesting. Thank you. Emily, do you want to take that? So basically what he's saying is if I buy it on my own, it's a certain price, but if I go through my insurance, it's jacked up?
Well, what he's saying is that your insurance company will pay the pharmaceutical company one price, and then there's, of course, the copay that you yourself actually feel. He's exactly right. I actually thought that my notes say the ProVigil is about $1,200 for a month's supply, so maybe it's changed over time.
Okay, so you're talking obviously about the copay, right, is different than what the insurance provider actually gives to the drug maker.
Right. However, the larger point is that the name brand companies cost way more to both the insurance company, and then as a result, our copays are typically higher than once generics come onto the market, where the price is much lower because of competition.
Okay. And Dr. Avorn, before we go to break, any quick thoughts on that?
Well, it's part of the same craziness of the U.S. healthcare system, where we end up spending about twice per person as we do as a lot of countries all over the rest of the world in industrialized countries pay for healthcare, but we're not getting any better outcomes for it. It's the American exceptionalism in a bad way.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And if we actually have full lines, we'll have one open in just a few minutes at 866-798-8255. Today, we are talking about the generic drug industry. 80% of all prescription drugs are generics. This market is expected to reach $169 billion next year worldwide. And so what questions do you have about generics, and how will these Supreme Court rulings affect those of us who take generic drugs? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Join us today on Your Call. It's always a better question, better program when we get involved and you ask your questions. If you'd like to share ideas or experience about today's conversation, call 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We just got breaking news that Bradley Manning was found not guilty of, quote, aiding the enemy as court-martial judge reads the verdict. It just came down in the last couple of minutes. Bradley Manning is the young man who leaked hundreds of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks. And according to the Washington Post, the military prosecutors argue that Manning, who is 25 years old, betrayed his oath and assisted Al-Qaeda because the group was able to access material once WikiLeaks posted it. And the court case took place over the last few weeks. And again, Bradley Manning found not guilty of, quote, aiding the enemy. And we were going to do a special show on Bradley Manning and what this case means tomorrow. So be sure to tune in for that. And then on Thursday, we're going to have a conversation about how we can prevent mega fires. We've been seeing them all over the country. And so we're going to talk about managing forests and wild lands. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the generic drug market. 70% of us take prescription drugs. 80% of those are generics. Two Supreme Court rulings came down that are very important for those of you who take generic drugs. We've been talking about the pay-for delay. And then we're going to talk in just a few minutes about another important decision, 5-4 decision, that will affect your ability to sue a generic drug maker for defective drugs. Today we're joined by Dr. Jerry Avorn, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and an internist in the Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's the author of Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. We're also joined by Emily Rush, state director at CalPERG, a nonprofit public interest advocacy organization. And let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from Andrea in Santa Cruz. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. How you doing? Getting a little bit away from the cost part of it. Now, for me, I guess I'm sort of one of the more fortunate ones that my insurance pays for my medication, so I don't have to worry about any co-pays, thank God. But I was just wondering if anybody on the panel there has any knowledge on something from the more health perspective. For example, I have severe chronic pain, and I take 8 milligrams Dilaudid and 30 milligram oxycodone, and I get 450 of the Dilaudids a month and then like 60 oxycodones for breakthrough pain. And I've been taking those medications for quite a long time, and I'll probably be on the medications for the rest of my life. And I'm just wondering, now there's other generic medications, I believe, such as Vicodin and Percocet. A couple of people have told me that will do a lot more harm to your body, particularly your liver, because they're full of acetaminophen. But drugs like oxycodone and Dilaudid aren't really that harmful to the body at all, because they're for moderate to severe pain, and they're not full of acetaminophen. And part of the reason why I got on those pills was because I was on the fentanyl patch for a while, and it stopped working. And my doctor wrote a prescription actually for these fentanyl lollipops, but those were too expensive for my insurance to cover, so he put me on the Dilaudid and the oxycodone.
Okay,
so.
Andrea, let's get a response from Dr. Avorn. Dr. Avorn, were you able to hear Andrea?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
And without being able to say anything specific about her own case,
right,
whether or not a drug is bad for your liver is only a matter of whether what the molecule is in it. So some of the combinations she mentioned, which actually she mentioned trade name drugs like Percocet and Vicodin, those are trade name drugs that do happen to contain acetaminophen, which is the active ingredient in Tylenol. And while it's true that too much acetaminophen is bad for your liver, that's not about whether they're generic or not. It's about whether the drug has got acetaminophen in it or not. And in fact, as I said, those were not generics, but trade names. So whether a drug is safe or dangerous or effective or not is all about what's the molecule in it and not about whether or not it's a trade name drug or a generic drug.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, and I hope that helps. We have an email from Carl who says, it sounds like a large part of the problem regarding delayed generics is the granting of frivolous and illegitimate patents via the standard criteria for granting patents for things like pill shape, that then serve as the basis for the settlements between the name brand and generic companies. Why are those patents granted in the first place? Dr. Avon?
That's a really good question. I don't know. Emily may have something to add on this. Basically, the patent office, I think, is in over its head in terms of a lot of decisions that they make about medications. They will sometimes grant a new patent for, as I said, either the coating of the pill, or if it is literally the right-handed molecule versus the left-handed molecule. An example of that is Nexium, which is simply the left-handed version of Prilosec, and it's exactly functionally the same drug. But these are tough determinations, and the folks in the patent office, like many federal employees, are overwhelmed and underpaid and understaffed, and they sometimes get it wrong, and they and companies know how to work the system like a violin and are able to get their way.
Wow. All right. Well, great question. Thank you so much. Let's go next to Anne in Santa Cruz. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the show. Hello, Anne? Sorry, we lost Anne. Anne said she's been trying to get her condition under control with a generic, but the brand name is the only thing that worked for her. Dr. Avorn, how often do you hear that?
Well, you hear it a fair amount. I just don't think that it's true. There is this thing called the placebo effect that we all know about, where if somebody really believes in a drug, it will work better than if they don't believe in it. But whenever a drug has been compared with its generic, and we've done some of these studies ourselves at Harvard Medical School, there really is no difference since it's the same molecule. But it has a very powerful effect if somebody says, oh, wow, this is the expensive trade name version versus this inexpensive generic. I think that sometimes does make people feel like the drug works better, but in general, that's not the case.
Well, this is interesting. Emily, what happens to the brand name drug once a generic comes out? Why would you even go for the brand name if you can access the generic?
A lot of it has to do with, I think, people's, they know the name. There's been a lot of marketing done of that drug. And so some people feel more comfortable with that brand and with that name because it's something that they've heard of before, that they're familiar with. Oftentimes, they haven't heard of the acetaminophen, you know, type name of the drug instead of the actual company and brand name. So that's the main reason why people often prefer
Drugs. Dr. Avorn, do we still have the problem where you write about this in your op-ed about just the salespeople talking to doctors about which drug to prescribe? Is there still a problem with doctors prescribing maybe the brand name, knowing that the insurance might pay for it?
Well, there certainly is a lot more promotion of brand name drugs because there's so much more money to be made. And the generic drug manufacturers tend not to have that big profit margin. There may be dozens and dozens of generic manufacturers for one drug, and they're making a fraction of a penny per pill. They're not going to have the wherewithal or the motive to send a sales rep into a doctor's office and ply them with all kinds of things that we sometimes get plied with, because it's just not economic for the generic companies. And so we have this unbalanced source of information where the most expensive brand name drugs are very heavily promoted to doctors as well as to patients with commercials on TV, and nobody takes out ads for generics or sends sales reps into your office to tell you about generic drugs.
Huh. Is that changing at all over the last couple of decades, just the amount of visits that doctors get and the pressure they're under to prescribe these brand name drugs when they can prescribe the generic?
Well, marketing continues to be a multi-billion dollar affair for the pharmaceutical industry. And what we've been trying to do here at Harvard in kind of a nonprofit way is a number of us try to get information out to doctors that is not about selling product, but just about giving them the best available medical information. And we do this just because we think it's important. We don't have any ties to drug companies that pay us to do this. And if any of your listeners are interested, we put all this stuff up for free for non-commercial use by patients and doctors on rxfacts.org, just for people to get a good unbiased source of information, rxfacts.org. And if anybody has a clinical issue they want to look at, just we put it up there so people can use it, and it's free of any kind of commercial influence.
Emily?
Oh, I just want to add that I think this kind of non-biased information is so important, but because so often in the medical industry, it's a company who is going to benefit from either selling their drug or selling their treatment or procedure. And so the information that they're putting out does have a natural bias towards, you know, what they are making or promoting. And that's why it's so important that we do have an amount of government funding for what we call comparative effectiveness research, in terms of what types of treatments that work best for patients, or in, you know, more specific cases, the kinds of drugs that work best for patients, so that we can actually get this kind of unbiased information that the doctor is talking about.
That is Emily Rush, State Director at CalPERG. Dr. Jerry Avorn is Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. And today we're talking about generic drugs. They make up 80% of all prescription drugs. It's a huge, huge number. And we'd love to hear from you. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions or comments about generic drugs, if you want to share your personal stories about generics, how much they cost, and then we'll have a line open in just a couple of minutes, 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Ruthann in Berkeley. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi there. Thank you so much for doing this show. It's very pertinent to what I was just undergoing. I wanted to comment on, first, you're saying, and I would agree with Dr. Avorn totally, that the generic is just the same molecule. I'm wondering two questions. One is why several doctors that I know and respect have just said of certain drugs that the name brand is better or more effective, whether it's an antibiotic or something else.
And where did you read that, or where did you hear that, Ruthann?
I've heard that from several. I've heard that personally.
Okay, so let's take that one first.
Well,
let's just take that one first, Ruthann. Hold
okay.
on the line. So, Dr. Avorn, we have that question again, that the brand name is better than the generic.
Right, there's a lot of disinformation out there, and there's it's hard to know quite where it comes from, but I know a lot of doctors say that, and I know that many of them truly believe it. It's just whenever you look at it carefully, that is just not proven to be the case, and we know that the FDA standards are such that they really don't allow the generic manufacturers to make a product that is anything less than the purity and potency of the drugs that are branded. So I you hear it a lot. I've heard it from patients and from other doctors. I just don't think that it's the case, and it's never really stood up in a convincing way in studies. Now, we've been trying to get the word out to doctors by taking a page from the book of the drug industry, where we've been supported by a couple of state governments to send people out who are kind of unsales reps to go to doctors' offices and teach them about what's the best way to prescribe for a given condition, what generics to use, when the brand names are not worth it, and if they are, when they are worth it. And it's called academic detailing, named after the detailers who are the drug company sales reps. But we do it in a non-commercial way to just try to get the public health message out to doctors so that the drug companies are not the only ones who are out there educating doctors in their offices. Mm-hmm.
Ruthann, which drug did you hear that about?
Oh, you know, I honestly don't remember.
Oh, okay. All right. So what's your second question?
The second question is, and I take very few, this would be connected to it, prescriptions, but I was taking Prosamax, and my doctor's office got samples, and I was taking samples for ages. Then it went generic, and I think they're not getting samples of the name brand anymore. My question would be, which is the first question I had, is why do you think I'm finding a huge discrepancy in the cost of even the generic?
Where do you find that?
Different places, like when I've been calling and trying to find out, because I'm responsible for paying for it. There's just a huge discrepancy.
Like from pharmacy to pharmacy?
Yeah.
Okay. Emily, do you know?
I do know that pharmacies can charge different amounts for drugs, and so I don't know why, and this is obviously a case where it actually does pay to shop around.
Dr. Avorn?
I agree with Emily. It's kind of like, you know, toothpaste or shampoo, that it's whatever the store chooses to charge for it, and as part of our somewhat strange marketplace approach to this, people can pay for the exact same product, just like for anything in a grocery store, different amounts for the same product in different locations.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you, Ruthann. So you got to shop around. I want to take a quick break from calls and talk about the second decision, because we're almost out of time. We've got about 15 minutes left, and I will definitely get to your calls in just a few minutes. So there was a 5-4 decision. The Supreme Court overturned a lower court ruling that had awarded Karen Bartlett, a woman from New Hampshire, $21 million for pain and suffering. This is just a horrific case. She took a generic version of Celindac. It's an anti-inflammatory drug. She had just basic shoulder pain. And after she took that drug, she got third-degree burns over more than half of her body, left permanently disfigured, legally blind, and with permanent damage to her lungs and esophagus. And Dr. Avorn, I mean, you've got everyone from the New York Times to Forbes magazine saying, okay, if you take generic drugs, you're basically out of luck. You have little recourse. I mean, where does this leave us if we take a generic drug and are left almost blind?
To be clear, in relation to the theme of the program today, it's not as if there was any question about whether the generic caused the problem that would not have been there if the Ms. Bartlett had taken the trade name. This is an inherent property of this compound called Celindac, and it can happen to you whether you get the generic version or the trade name version, which was called Clineril. The interesting problem with the court case was that this case and another one of a while back called Pliva versus Mensing, which sounds a little obscure. Mensing was a patient who also had a drug side effect from a generic drug. Again, not because it was generic, but what the courts said in that earlier decision is you can't sue a generic manufacturer because they have to go with the same warnings as the trade name drug does. And in the case of the more recent case of Bartlett, there was another sort of legal wrinkle that we don't have to get into about whether the drug was defective. But the argument was not that generic drugs are less safe, but that if you have a manufacturer without deep pockets, you can't sue them. And that's really the fix that patients are in, especially because, as you mentioned, 80% of prescriptions are generic. This really, unless Congress does something to change the law, this leaves patients without anybody that they can sue if they have a drug side effect. But again, not because it was a generic, but because it was made by a generic company.
Ah, okay. That's probably one of the better explanations I've heard, because that very important piece of information is missing in a lot of these articles about this case. I think people are kind of shocked by it. And so even, you know, Forbes magazine, Merck wins a key ruling that bolsters the pharmaceutical industry. Emily, what are your thoughts?
Right. And I think a central point here is that the generic companies right now are using the same labels as the name brand companies. So we have two recommendations coming out of this court ruling. First of all, consumers who are injured by drugs because there's inadequate warning labels on those drugs, they should be able to recover damages regardless of whether or not they're taking a name brand drug or a generic. And that's something fundamental that we believe in that this court obviously came on the wrong side of.
And so Karen Bartlett, she was awarded $21 million in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
But then a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court overturned that ruling.
Right. So we do think that at the end of the day, consumers, I mean, we need to have accurate labels about potential side effects. But then generic companies should have both the authority and the incentive to update their labels. It's my understanding that the Food and Drug Administration is proposing a new rule on this issue in September. And so we're going to be looking closely at that and encouraging them to make sure that the drug companies actually have the incentive to make the labels clear to consumers.
Dr. Avorn, what do generic drug makers need to let citizens know about on the label? Because when you listen to the ads on television, the person speaks so quickly. But, I mean, they say so much in less than a minute. And you can't even hear it because they're talking so fast. But what do they have to put on the label?
Right. And this is a very big problem that I think, as Emily says, can be fixed by this proposed new rule that FDA has put out there, although it may take years and years for it to work its way through the system. What we need is some body or some incentive for getting a handle on the adverse effects of drugs once they go generic and once the trade name manufacturer may no longer even be making it or may not want to make an investment in looking at it. And what Dr. Kesselheim and my group and I are proposing is that we ought to have some entity supported by the federal government whose job is to look at the risks of old drugs, generic or not generic, and as Emily says, put them back on kind of a level playing field so that we can know which we doctors and we patients can know which drugs cause what side effects, and it shouldn't matter whether it's a generic drug or a trade name drug. But we need to have the federal government be proactive about making that happen. Even a couple of pennies per pill would probably pay for a very effective program of surveillance of drugs that are on the market, and we'd love to see that move forward.
All right, we're talking today about generic drugs. We've got about 7 minutes left, and I'll try to take as many calls as I can. Why don't we take a few in a row, and then we'll get Dr. Avorn and Emily to respond. Let's go to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I started my career 25 years ago in pharmaceuticals, and I do agree very much with the doctor about the aggressive pricing and some of the other behaviors of the branded pharmaceutical industry. He is correct. However, I would like to take a slightly different point that the generic is not always 100% equivalent of the branded drug. And in our own family, my mother's case with Coumadin, a blood thinner after heart surgery, we did not know that she was switched from branded Coumadin to warfarin, the generic. And while the active ingredients that helped the patient keep their blood thin was the same, the side effects of her losing all of her hair only happened with the transition to generics. It was a rare 2% side effect, but it was the inert or blending ingredients in the pills that caused my mother to lose her hair. And only after they figured that rare side effect out were they able to get her back on the branded drug, and sure enough, her hair grew back.
Wow. Well, I'm glad your mom figured that out. Thank you for calling in. We actually have an email from Gabrielle who says, I have been taking different branded medications that have worked for me, whereas the generic did not. So thank you for that email, Gabrielle. And we'll get a comment in just a couple minutes. Let's hear from Kevin in Santa Cruz. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks. I'd like to address this continuous assertion.
Oops. Sorry about that, Kevin. Kevin said that he's irritated by the idea that generics are identical to brand. And Julie in San Francisco also has a comment about generics. Hi, Julie.
I had a thyroidectomy years ago because of cancer, and I didn't know that there were differences between different thyroid drugs, whether it's just generic and name brand or not, I don't know. But my pharmacist said, here, you can take the generic. Fortunately, these are not very expensive drugs anyway. I took the generic, didn't think anything of it. Started having a lot of crazy things happening, my heart rate going really fast, everything cut.
Hello?
Hello? Sorry, we're having some phone problems. Dr. Avorn, are you with us? No, I think we dropped Dr. Avorn. So we're just getting a lot of people writing in saying that they had different experiences with generics and brand name.
Right. And I mean, ultimately, I'm not a doctor, obviously.
Yeah.
But
we're getting the doctor back on.
You know, but I will say this is something that patients can work out with their doctors and talk to their doctors about. And ultimately, CalPERC certainly isn't advocating that we take brand name drugs off the market entirely. And that is still a choice that doctors and patients can make together. But we are opposed to this practice where the generics aren't even available on the marketplace because of pay-for-delay deals.
Dr. Avorn, are you back with us?
Yes, I am
okay,
back.
Sorry about that. Okay. So we're just getting, it seems like we're getting a lot of calls and emails from people who are talking about the differences between generics and brand name drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Personal experiences.
This does fit with what you hear, and it is rarely the case that if there is in a generic or in a branded drug something that is there as filler, and it can happen with trade name drugs too, that a person may have a less good reaction to it. But again, it's very, very unusual for that to be the case, and it can happen with both a brand name and with a generic drug. And I think the rest of the difference that people perceive is really more about placebo effect, I'm afraid, than anything chemical about the drugs themselves.
We have an email from Denise who says, will this decision, the Supreme Court decision, affect the VA where there is one price for all drugs? Right now, the VA can bargain drug prices, and this bargaining was forbidden in Obamacare.
Very good point. And the VA is really a model of what we ought to have been doing for the rest of the healthcare system, where the VA does negotiate very effectively to get good prices, unlike Medicare, which was forbidden from doing so by legislation in Congress, and is not going to happen under Obamacare either. But yeah, the VA gets very good drugs at incredibly good prices, and I wish the rest of the country was allowed to do that, as most other countries, in fact, do.
And Dr. Avon, we've done several shows about the pharmaceutical industry over the years, and it's kind of amazing to watch it just continue to explode. I mean, 70% of Americans now take drugs. 80% of those are generics. Do you think that the numbers will just continue increasing?
Well, yeah, but the good news is that we do also get a lot of benefit from medications. It's not as if how can we have fewer people, taking, although there is over-medicalization and some people take drugs they don't need. For the most part, most drugs make people better, and that's a good thing. We just need to figure out how to make them affordable and make sure that their risks are known, and those are things which we need to do a better job on. And by the way, there's a website that Consumer Reports maintains that your listeners might benefit from. If you just go to Consumer Reports, they have a program called Best Buy Drugs, where they do for medications what they do for cars and air conditioners and refrigerators, which is they rank them, and they do a very good job of it. And that's a nice user-friendly place to go and find out about what drugs are both safe and effective and a good buy.
Great. Thank you. And we'll put that link on our website. Emily, 30 seconds. What's the best way to empower yourself to just educate yourself if you take generic drugs?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that you should, if you are taking medication right now, you should know whether or not you're taking a generic or a name brand drug and ask your doctor about alternatives, if there are cheaper alternatives to what you're currently being prescribed. So it's more about actually if you're taking a name brand drug, you might be able to save money by finding an alternative. And that is really important. I mean, and the consumer should be empowered to do that. And likewise, along with your caller's comment about pharmacies, if you are paying out of pocket for your drugs, make sure to shop around to get the best deal.
All right. Thank you. Emily Rush is State Director at CalPERG, a nonpartisan public interest advocacy organization. Thank you so much for that great information. And Dr. Jerry Avorn is Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, author of Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. And Dr. Avorn, thank you so much. And thanks for really explaining that Supreme Court decision in the way that you did, because I think it's such an important case. So thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Who is Bradley Manning and what was the case against him all about? On the next Your Call, we'll speak about Bradley Manning, the soldier who released massive amounts of classified information to WikiLeaks. A military judge found him not guilty of, quote, aiding the enemy, but he may still face more than 100 years in prison for lesser charges. How will this verdict affect future whistleblowers? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.